In October 2020, two brothers began recording a podcast about the horror movies they love. All things seemed successful till they vanished in March of 2021. Now they have returned, the same, yet somehow different. You're listening to Horror Brothers. Everybody, welcome back to Horror Bros. I'm your host Jason Johnson, along with
JT Johnson. How's it going?
Yeah, it's pretty wild out there, you know. Yeah, shows happening and heat, unbelievably horrific heat outside. You walk outside and you feel like you're gonna melt. We've been having 109 degree days, so.
I meant to ask you this before we got on the mic, but you seemed kind of a little mellow yellow today, and I wonder, was it the heat or you?
Yeah, I'm just kind of sitting here, man. I'm just here today. I've been running and gunning all week, so I was ready for a nice relaxing day today.
Well, I tell you what, why don't I prime us with just a tidbit of horror news before we get into our movie?
Let's do it.
Just a little bit. Just a tidbit. It's actually a first image. There was also a poster released of Peter Dinklage as the Toxic Avenger in the Toxic Avenger remake. I didn't even know this was a thing until this image was released.
Yeah. I've been hearing for a while now that they were going to redo Toxic Avenger. I had no idea that Peter Dinklage was going to be Toxie, and I had no idea that it was even filming yet or anything. I mean, it's wild.
And the image release was nothing like too crazy. I mean, it was just basically him silhouette, and you see the glowing mop.
Right.
And they did release a poster, which also revealed that Elijah Wood and Kevin Bacon are in the movie. So
nice.
I'm interested. It's set to premiere at next month at Fantastic Fest 2023.
Cool.
I don't know where that is. I don't know how you get to it, but anyway, it's going to premiere there, and then afterwards, I guess they'll figure out where it's going to go. As far as either streamers or theaters or whatever. Beyond that, not much in the realm of horror news. The Last of the Demeter came out last week. I'm still waiting to watch it tomorrow as of this recording. But I did hear that like it's going to be kind of a flop for Universal. They've had two Dracula flops this year at the box office with Renfield and now this movie. But Renfield was good, so I'm still holding out hope that it was good. It's just that nobody's watching it because nobody can stop Barbie, except for maybe the Blue Beetle, which is hilarious as hell.
Real quick, just to interject here. Just looked up Fantastic Fest on September 21st through the 28th in Austin, Texas.
Ooh.
Yeah, let's see how much I can't afford the tickets. Let's see.
Courtney, I'll tell you this though. Courtney and I are setting the dates for next May for Texas Frightmare.
Oh,
we really want to go to that. We wanted to go the past couple of times, but now I think we can actually plan for it since it's a few months out. And
let's see here. Right now, the only thing they have available are second half badges for $275. A fan badge, which gets you $545 worth of entertainment. Superfan is sold out. And then you have cult member. And for cult member status, which is, of course, everything, that's only $1,495.
This must be like one of the bigger fests
according to this, it's a week long. So
it's
the 21st through the 28th. Yeah, this is it's an entire week long. So
That's the one thing I actually haven't done since getting back into horror films a few years ago, is that I haven't, I say a few years ago, 10 years ago when The Conjuring came out, I've never really looked into the horror film festivals or festivals in general, conventions, what have you.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what's out there. I know Texas Frightmare is a big one because the reason we wanted to go to last year's was because Robert Englund was there.
Yeah.
And
this one, apparently, it's all horror, fantasy, sci-fi, action, and just plain fantastic movies. Fantastic Fest is for the love of the genre. It's the largest genre film festival in the U.S. So, yeah, it's in, so yeah, seven days. It's going to be pretty wild. So, anyway, yeah, that's about it there, though. That's
well,
cool.
Well, Jason, I believe I went first last week.
You did.
And it's not just because I went first last week. I wanted you to go first because the movie you did end up choosing, which we didn't know last week, which I'll let you reveal here in just a second, you'd never seen it before. Like, this was a new one for you.
Absolutely.
So that's I don't have the patience to make it through my movie.
Right.
To hear your thoughts on this movie. What did you watch?
I've had a year that I've been had this on my list of shit to watch, but I just haven't watched it because, you know, stuff slips by, you know, time keeps on slipping, as Steve Miller would say. Anyway, I watched The Black Phone, a fantastic fucking movie. Holy shit. I went into this having heard that it was good. I didn't realize exactly what I was getting into. It's not just good. It's amazing. I love this movie. It is, of course, about a young man. They're in 1978 Denver. There are kids being abducted in town by a man called the Grabber. Then the movie basically takes place around this one young man who gets abducted, and a 13-year-old boy named Finn, and he gets locked in a soundproof basement, and the only thing in the room is a bed, and then on the phone on the wall is a phone, a black phone, but it's not connected to anything. But he starts getting calls on that phone, and it's from the previous boys that this child abductor / serial killer has killed. The Grabber, that is. It stars Mason Timms as Finn, Madeline McGraw as Gwen, his sister. Ethan Hawke plays the Grabber. Ethan Hawke doesn't play the Grabber. Ethan Hawke becomes the Grabber. He, in for very little dialogue, just his motions, the way he carries himself, very intimidating, very, just perfect. Perfect in every possible way. Jeremy Davies plays Finn and Gwen's father, Terrence, and there's a whole thing there that is just amazing. I'll talk about in a moment. E. Roger Mitchell is Detective Wright. Tony Rudisill as Detective Miller. James Ransom as Max. And Miguel Mora as Robin. I think he's of the boys that were captured, which he's the most important. And he's fantastic in the film, too, for the bit that he's in it. Everyone in this movie put on a stellar performance, no matter how little they are in this movie. There is an underlying theme to this film of this guy, Finn, this kid, needing to stand up for himself. There has been some tragedy in the family. The father is coping with that with alcohol, which turns him abusive, which, you know, man, you want to hate him. You absolutely want to fucking hate him. But Jeremy Davies plays him with this underlying thing of, no, this man he doesn't hate his children. He loves his children and all, but he's been through this tragedy with the mom, you know, having taking her own life, and he's just dealing with it in the only way that he knows how. And so, yeah, you can't stand him for the shit he is doing to his children, but you understand it and you know he's hurting and you know, and by the end of it, he is redeemed a bit. So,
and there's an understanding that he sees something, particularly in his daughter,
right?
That is what drove his wife
right.
nuts and that's, forced her to kill herself. And so that's always at play. Even
and that's
if not
what I'm
explicitly stated. Yes.
Yeah. And that's what I'm about to get into there too, is why he sees things in his daughter. Why he's basically, you know, old school. I mean, shit, I grew up with this, you know, old school dad, you know, if I need to make you understand something, I'm going to beat it into you. You know, it's cause, and so anyway, here's the cool part of this movie is, based on a short story written by, Joe Hill. For those that don't know out there, his full name is, that's his pen name. His full name is Joseph Hillstrom King. That's right. Stephen King's son wrote the,
and boy, can you tell that he's his son in this movie?
Yeah. Yeah, and definitely, because it, and I'll tell you, I have steered clear of Joe Hill writing for years, because, you know, I get worried that I'm going to read it, and it's going to be like, oh, he's just a reasonable facsimile of his dad. Does he write a lot like his dad? Yes. Is it as good as his dad? 100%. With this story, and I'm going to be, I'm now going to, I went to my Audible app immediately and started like, okay, I got 10 credits. Let me get a bunch of Joe Hill shit. So I'm gonna start listening to it. But with that being said, we have this movie that, and this is one of the parts I love. I don't know if you would agree on this, but the standalone story of the grabber kidnapping him, they could have done it without the supernatural element. He could have been slowly finding clues in the room that these kids left behind. There didn't have to be this supernatural element. But that being said, it's just an ingenious way of him finding these clues, adding the supernatural element of it, and then also with his sister, and this is what you were discussing, you know, her father knowing she has these psychic dreams. She can see things that are happening or have happened and are going to happen. She starts having dreams where she sees the house where Finn is being kept. And then we come to find out the reason the father is drinking is the mother took her life because she had had visions too. And they told her to do bad things, so she took her own life. Now, whether or not that was the mother had schizophrenia, and he interpreted his daughter's dreams as the same thing, or she actually was psychic and the daughter got the shine from her.
I was about to say, on a particular shine?
Yeah. Red rum. Anyway.
You're ripping off your dad, Joe.
Yeah. Listen, Joe, I'll be honest with you, rips off his dad a little bit and everything, but he rips it off well. You know, a lot of people don't know this in the story, The Black Phone, that this is pulled from. In the movie, it's the grabber is a magician in real life, and that's his day job. The book, though, guess what he was?
Clown?
A clown, yes. So, yes, yeah. But man alive, it's good. The movie is so good. I just, like I say, I love the fact, I loved all the paranormal stuff with the kids caught. And what's cool is, each one of these kids that this guy has killed before gives Finn a little clue of how to get out of this. And in the end, when they do it and he's running through his plan, they go through the plan at full speed, but they do it in a way where you're seeing, oh shit, he's using every one of these little clues. Nothing is skipped. You can see it all, you know, and oh man, it was so good.
Yeah, it's definitely like what I call a Usual Suspects movie, where everything that you're, all the information you're being given is going to come together in a unique way by the end of it. But let's face facts. This movie does not work without a great villain.
Yeah.
And Ethan Hawke, who initially didn't want to play this role because he didn't want to be remembered as a villain.
Right. Right.
But then he realized, I'm 51, so maybe villains are now just in my future at this point.
Well, and not only that, but he read the script, and and they said that he called, oh shit, who said, it was the director, Scott Derrickson. He sent him the script, he read the script, and immediately called Derrickson back as the grabber. He started talking like he does as the grabber, and he said that's when he knew he had him hooked, because the story was just too good to pass up.
And he wears these masks that also allows him to, he has to act with his voice and his eyes.
Yeah, and his body. He emotes. Yeah, this, and man alive, it's good. These masks are amazing. Love them. Designed by Tom Savini, the horror master of effects and makeup and stuff.
And that was their alternative to the clown plot in the book. It was a way to have him have something on his face.
Right, right.
Although there is one scene where they hint that he may dress up as a clown too, because there's one, because when he's kidnapping Finn, he's got a pale face, like he's had makeup on. But it's cool. It's more subtle than it is in the story.
Yeah, it's just it's great. God, I can't say enough good about. In fact, I hate saying anything about this movie, because I don't feel like I have the words to tell you how much I love this fucking movie. It's that good.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give a couple quick facts. Director Scott Derrickson, if that name sounds familiar, he had directed Doctor Strange before this movie.
Okay.
He had also directed some other indie horror films beforehand. He was supposed to direct Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, but he quit over that fabled creative differences that people often quit for.
Right.
And thank God he did, because that's when he was able to move on to making this movie.
Yeah.
And, he worked with Ethan Hawke in Sinister. So that was another thing. That's how he could also help pull Ethan Hawke into the movie. The character of the grabber with one particular mask and a top hat. It's the one on the poster.
Yeah.
Has been compared to Lon Chaney's appearance in London After Midnight.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, I was like, oh shit, yeah, that is what that is. I don't want to say too much more about the movie, because to say too much more would just spoil it.
Right.
And so I definitely understand that. Another Blumhouse movie, and these guys know how to micro budget and make a profit. $18 million went on to gross over $161 million.
Yeah.
Here's some interesting things. Here's something interesting. Derrickson said that Joe Hill was very protective of the story, but after the movie came out and was a success, Joe Hill came to him with an idea for a sequel.
Yeah.
And here recently, Jason Blum was talking to his investors this year, and he mentioned The Black Phone as their newest franchise. So we may not have seen the end of The Grabber. And as long as Derrickson, Hill, and Blumhouse is involved, I'm interested to see what they can do. Now, I will admit, this is one of those movies where I'm kind of like, okay, pal.
Yeah.
But
I'm thinking prequels.
Well, there's either prequels or maybe something else can come through the phone.
Yeah.
Or
maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pull a shocker where, he goes through the electrical lines after being executed, you know. Shocker. I hadn't thought about that movie in years.
I haven't either. In fact, I haven't seen that movie in so long, I can't remember it. I just know I want to rewatch it at some point. But I want to point out a couple other performances, though. I think Madeline McGraw as Gwen, the sister.
She was awesome.
She was amazing. I loved watching her. Just absolutely charming. A lot of sass. Just, you don't piss Gwen off. And you can tell that, like, there's a point in the movie where the father's concerned. They have a heart-to-heart, basically. And the father, Terrence, is like, this happened with your mother, and I don't want you to go through that. And you can tell Gwen is stronger than that. Like, Gwen doesn't mind.
Yeah.
Gwen doesn't mind saying, Jesus, where the fuck are you? Because she prays to Jesus.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, then I guess I'm going to have to come to the conclusion, you don't exist. When it seems that Jesus is there. Then, of course, at one point, she's like, I'm sorry, Jesus, I hope you exist.
Yeah.
I love that. And then there's E. Roger Mitchell. And was it Tony or Troy Rudisill?
Let me see here. Troy.
Yeah. They play Detective Wright and Detective Miller. And yes, I mean, even on screen, they're your typical detectives. But you know what I love about them? They don't just write Gwen off. They, you know, normally, like, the kid sees a vision. Oh, the kid sees a vision. Well, I can't work on a vision, kid.
Right,
no, these cops are like, oh, this house? Oh, let's go to this house, because fuck it, we can't find this guy. Let's fucking use it.
Well, and, you know, I think there was that initial, you know, one where they interview her, and they're like, how do you know that? And I loved her reaction of, oh, yeah, I'm the one who abducted him. You know, I'm this little girl. Yeah, way to go, dipshits. You know, but you know, she ends up convincing him pretty much that, you know, I have these dreams sometimes, and sometimes they're real. And because she knows information that the public doesn't know, they don't go with the whole, yeah, whatever, kid. No, they really run with it. And so.
And that was a nice twist on that old trope of the detectives. Yeah.
And also, you know, something else too, this is 1978, and there were a lot of these psychics that would go to the cops in those days and be like, hey, I can help you find this person. I'm getting visions and whatnot, you know. Most of them, yes, one day turned out to be frauds. But there are a few cases out there where they got shit eerily right.
It almost makes you wonder if, like, there are a few Sean Spencers out there, if you don't remember that character, the character from Psych.
Okay,
And I think that's his name in the show, but, you know, where he's just really good at observing, but he's really psychic. You know?
Right.
But another performance in this movie, I'll tell you, is Miguel Mora as Robin. Yeah, it's not a hefty role. Basically, that's Finney's friend, and Finney's friend that gets abducted before he does.
Yeah.
And he has a very important role, but I thought I was going to hate that character at first, to be honest, because, oh, yeah, the tough kid, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But his overall arc and how it serves Finney, again, it just comes through in this story. And
right.
I see it there. And that actor did a really good job. And then you're wondering, like, why is he telling him step forward, step back, step forward, swing? You know, like, why is he telling him this weird move that is not like a fucking martial arts move or anything?
Right.
But
right.
It will come in handy at some point. He was great. And then finally, there's one, I think you mentioned him, but James Ransom as Max.
Yeah.
The
I don't want to say who he is.
I don't either. He's a great character.
He's a great character. Yeah, he's a great character. He's only in it for a couple of scenes. The funny part is the middle scene, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, is very kind of funny. It's, you know, the way it goes. And they specifically mentioned that they put that scene in. Scott Derrickson said this, that because they realized at that point in the film, audiences needed a fucking break. Because it had been so, fucking just creepy. Listen, there is one scene in this movie that will make me a fan of Ethan Hawke for life and think he just deserves all the awards. And he doesn't even fucking say anything in it. When he's sitting in that fucking chair, watching that doorway, just waiting for this kid to try and escape. And he ain't got a shirt on. He's just sitting there with a belt in his hand. He's got that mask on. Holy shit, dude. Just his presence on the screen gave me chills, you know?
When I rewatched it last night, I forgot how intense the movie can be just from a tense tone. It's nothing's happening. Nothing is going on. But right. You just know that, like, something's around the corner. Something is that this evil presence is in the room.
Yes.
And just a fantastic movie. And the music by Mark Corvin, I think, helps sells it too. It's a really good score mixed in with 70s songs as well.
Right.
Of its era. Really good. Really good movie.
Yep.
I don't want to say any more than that.
Yeah, I want to leave it here because, I think we can go ahead on and move on to yours and see what you watched, which I know what it is, and it's a movie that I love, so.
And boy, howdy, can we spoil the shit out of this one.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I chose a little bit of levity. We're going back to the 1980s. We're going back to a time, an innocent time, when apparently malls were so popular that you had to arm them with military-grade, bulky, Johnny Five-esque robots.
Yes.
And the movie is, of course, Killbots, yes. A.K.A. Chopping Mall. I say Killbots because it was originally released in a limited release as Killbots. There's even a trailer featuring that title. But after it tested poorly with audiences, rumor has it they went back to go and get another title. And the janitor at Concord Pictures, which is a company that was owned by the famed producer Roger Corman, a janitor said, "Why don't you call it Chopping Mall?" And that was it. That was the end of the story. That's how easy you could change a story. But my official synopsis for the movie is, after murderous robots come to life in a mall that they're supposed to protect, they malfunction and begin to think that the group of teens stuck in the mall are targets. Now the teens must find a way to stop the robots before the machines take them out first. It's that simple of a plot. This movie is 75 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's not a long movie. It was basically, the way it came about was producer Julie Corman, Roger Corman's wife, had made a deal with Vestron to make a movie set in the mall.
Yeah.
And Jim Wynorski, who would later go on to direct several softcore porn films, he readily admits, he said, "I got into filmmaking for money and chicks." And he said, "The cheapest special effects is a pair of breasts." So that's the kind of director we're dealing with. But he went to Corman and said to her, "I'll write the movie cheap. I just get to direct it. That's my fee."
Yeah.
And I mean, this is the House of Corman. Okay, you want to direct? Fuck it.
Yeah.
We'll save a nickel.
Go try.
You direct it. Yeah. So he pulls in co-writer Steve Mitchell. Steve Mitchell, in 24 hours, develops the story, just the basic outline. Yeah. Without a script, Vestron goes, "Good, go ahead, do it." And then it takes them 4 to 5 weeks to finish the script that they actually used.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it took them that long to write the script. And don't get me wrong, I fucking love this movie, but it's a very simple plot.
Right.
They said during filming that the only thing that concerned them was Roger Corman. How was he going to perceive it? Because he, of course, oversees every film he was ever over.
Right.
Even though it was his wife producing it. And they got word back that those kids are doing a fine job, is what Roger Corman said. So after that, they were relieved.
Yeah.
And they did do a fine job.
Yeah.
The movie stars Kelly Maroney as Allison. Horror fans may remember her more from Night of the Comet. She's the little sister. Tony O'Dell plays Ferdy, the love interest of Kelly, of Allison's. Russell Todd is Rick. He's like the macho Rambo one that, like, takes charge a little bit in the movie.
Yeah.
Barbara Crampton of Reanimator fame, she plays Susie. Carrie Emerson plays Rick's girlfriend, Linda. Susie Slater plays Leslie, who has a very interesting, they do the thing in the credits where they they show the picture of the actor.
Yeah.
From, like, it's from a scene from a movie and put their credit up. She's the one who gets her head blown off. I'll just go ahead and say it. And they use the exploding head
right.
and her title in the credits, which always just kills me.
Yeah.
Then there's John Terleski as Mike, Nick Siegel as Greg. And I think Greg's the one that owns this or runs the store that they're partying in.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is a brief cameo from Fame B horror movie actor Dick Miller as yep. Walter. He plays a janitor named Walter.
If it's a Corman film, it'll have Dick Miller.
It'll have Dick Miller in it. And how we got to see this movie was actually pretty recent. You and me both. It was yeah. on The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs.
Yep.
And for a few episodes of his show, we both were watching and we would text back each other. And right. I'll never forget when this movie came on and Chopping Mall showed up. I just remember one of us, I can't remember if it was you to me or me to you, texting and going, oh, this is going to be a good one.
Yeah. yeah.
You just knew it out the gate. A good B exploitation.
Oh, hell yeah.
Movie. Yeah. And yes, you're sitting there. You want to sit there and go, okay, come on. This is a fucking mall.
Yeah.
And yet there's these blast doors that lock them in. There's right. the fucking three robots that have lasers.
Yeah.
That have freaking lasers yeah. on their heads. as well as like tasers and all sorts yeah. of other shit. And you know what? The effects are pretty damn good.
Yeah. For what it is.
Low yeah. budget movie. These robots are fucking fun to watch. It's fucking hilarious. There's yeah. one point where there's that like luggage carrier vehicle that's in the mall. Which
yeah.
what it's doing in the mall, I don't know. And the guy gets on there with the AK. He's like 10 feet away from the fucking robot. Gets on this slow moving fucking luggage carrier yeah. with this fucking M4 and is like, ah! And then just
well,
that's the kind of movie we're dealing with.
And let's
here,
not let's not just breeze past that. We're you know, you ask why did they need these high tech robots with laser beams to protect them all? But you have to remember, this was in the day when there was a full-on gun store in the mall, which I'll tell you, this it's so funny because every time they base some sort of a horror movie in a mall, that's the setting for it. I'm sure they're sitting, I know this has to be what it is. They're sitting in the writer's room going, hey, man, I mean, they're going to need weapons of some kind. And, you know, we're Americans. We need guns. How the fuck are they going to get guns in a mall? And someone just looks up and goes, ah, just put a fucking gun store in the fucking mall, you know? And
or Jimbo Sporting Goods.
Right,
or
yeah,
because
they have these, you know, just gigantic gun stores in these malls that have all kinds of heavy fucking artillery. Wild shit, you know, just to, like you say, assault rifles that are spitting out automatic fire and shit. But yeah, I love that. I love that trope from the 80s because, of course, I'm an 80s kid. I went to fuck tons of malls and never saw one with a gun store in it ever.
I will say, though, that the movie does have some horror royalty. I already mentioned Maroni from Night of the Comet.
Right.
But she was originally actually supposed to be played by Dana Kimmel, who was yeah. the star of Friday the 13th Part 3. But this movie still features other people as well. And that is, I remember mentioning this to you. Hey, Russell Todd from Friday the 13th Part 2. Jesus, I am a horror fan because I'm only one of 10 people who would even point that out. But it also has a very small role in the opening scene. You see this kid carrying out like a fucking TV under his shirt. Like it's got the hilariously square shaped box under his shirt. It's obvious he's shoplifting something huge. That's actually Rodney Eastman. It's his first film role. He's not credited in the movie, but he would go on to appear as Joey in A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, and A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master.
Nice.
I love making these connections because, like, a lot of these low budget horror films in the 80s starred the same people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd already mentioned Barbara Crampton. That was the other one. She was Reanimator, which, oh my God, one day we will cover that movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But Maroney, what's funny about that is the director has, and again, this dude is brutally honest.
Yeah.
He readily admits this shit. He admitted that the reason he wanted Maroney is he saw her in her other projects, wanted to date her, and thought, well, if I cast her in this movie, maybe I'll get a chance to date her.
Yeah, yeah.
both Maroney and Wynorski have stated nothing untoward happened. It's just, you know, he thought, well, maybe I could ask her out at some point.
Right.
But there's really not much more to say about this movie except to say that this kind of movie is for... is for the fan of B horror movies. If you like, if you love the schlock, if you love the cheese, this is one of the ultimate ones, and it's very well made schlock. I mean, it's they do a good job with it, and every time I watch it, I'm just happy. just having a happy time with it. Because you can't take it serious as far as like serious horror. Like, it's not going to come out and scare you or anything like that. It's one of those where it's like, how are these people going to die? And is it going to be inventive?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's my takes on Job Mall. You want to add anything else to that, Jason?
I love this film. I love the fact, you know, for those of y'all that were fans of USA Up All Night and Night Flight, if you're around my age, which it's me saying those two things, you'll know what I mean. Basically, those were shows back where they had a host that would come on, and then they would that host would show us B movies. In fact, for USA Up All Night, for years it was Gilbert Gottfried, and so. I love movies like that because they kind of take me back to my childhood and these silly things that happen in them and stuff, you know, the kind of scary movie you could watch and never be scared because it was so obviously fake, but it was just so much fun to watch, especially if you were sitting around with your buddies. It harkens back to the days of Death Race 2000, you know, or something like that, you know? I love the movie. Yeah, it's a great film.
Yeah, for me, growing up in the 90s, that show was Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs. On TNT.
Yeah.
And Dad and I would watch that. One of my favorite times of Monster Vision, and I want to do a special on this franchise one day, was he stayed up all night watching the Friday the 13th films. They did an all-night marathon.
Oh, that's amazing.
And the footage is still out there, and I rewatched it the other day, and I love it because they didn't have the rights to Friday the 13th for the final chapter. So when he gets to it, he's like, we're going to watch Friday the 13th for the final. So what do you mean we don't have it?
Yeah.
It's the best one.
Yeah.
He said, well, here's Friday the 13th, part 5, A New Beginning. Like, right. It just kind of carries on. And meanwhile, they make it seem like Jason's on set killing off his crew and stalking him. And it's just, it was great. But you're right. That's kind of what this kind of movie harkens back to, is when people like him would show those movies that nobody else wanted to show. And in those days,
pre-internet days. He's the one who showed this film to us on the last drive-in on Cheddar.
That's fucking great. By the way, not an endorsement. Or he's not an official sponsor, but I will endorse him every day.
Oh, yeah, Joe Bob. I love that dude. In fact, I would like to do a special episode one day on just him, you know, and where he comes from and what he's done in his career, you know, and how he got to be this guy who was just the king of horror, you know.
His writing days in Dallas to his Showtime show and then to Monster Vision, which I always loved. Monster Vision.
His appearance on Married with Children.
Which I loved his drive-in totals on Monster Vision because he had to be censored in that one because it's on basic cable. And I always used to love it. He'd do his drive-in totals. He'd be like, He'd be like, one chopped off head, 10 breast. Not going to see that. Thank you, TNT. Yeah. Because they were so low budget show that the studio didn't pay attention to them.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. And so, it's great that legend introduced us to this movie, Chopping Mall, which I absolutely I love it. And I don't think there's really much more to say about that.
Yeah. Are you going to be putting up reviews on?
Just getting to that. I was going to say before we got to our ratings for our movies, right. On the Horror Bros blog, I still need to share them as of this record, as we're recording. But by the time this is uploaded, I should have shared them already to our Facebook group and to my profile page, JT Johnson, on Facebook.
Awesome.
I don't have Twitter or X or whatever the fuck it's called these days.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think many people are going to have X here soon. So
yeah. But on the Horror Bros blog, which is, again, located at horrorbros.blogspot.com, I do have a review for Chopping Mall.
Yeah.
I do not have a review for The Black Phone because you chose it kind of late in the week.
Yeah.
I watched it last night.
Yeah.
And I like to do my reviews after I've rewatched the movie, fresh in my mind. But I did release two more. I'm still going to go watch The Last Voyage of the Demeter, so there will be a review for that eventually. So this time, since I did Bram Stoker's Dracula last week, I actually wrote a review for 1931's Dracula, the Bela Lugosi film. So that's up, and in order to celebrate its 50th anniversary, we covered this movie in the first iteration of the show.
Yeah.
I wrote a review for The Exorcist.
Oh, 50
years old this year, come December 26th, because they released it the day after Christmas. The balls on Warner Brothers to do that.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
You've had your Christ, now have your Satan.
Yep. That's awesome that they put that out that day. I love it. God, 50 years. Man,
And another reason to post it is because come October 13th, The Exorcist Believer comes out. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Do you want to rate these puppies?
Sure. Jason, what do you give The Black Phone? Let you go first.
I give it 10 out of 10 black balloons. Watch the movie. You'll realize what I'm talking about.
I give it 5 out of 5 raw pork chops. You'll understand that, too, whenever you watch the movie. I almost just said 5 out of 5 black phones because...
Yeah.
That's the obvious one.
Right.
And
Chopping Mall. Go ahead and tell me what you think of it.
5 out of 5 exploding heads.
There you go. Yeah. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10 gun shops in a mall. Because that just blows my mind every time I see it.
There you go. And I will say this, there is one thing that film critics have said about Chopping Mall that they've picked up on, and that I put this in my written review, and that is that this film kind of comments on consumerism and capitalism, kind of like the way Dawn of the Dead did.
Yeah.
Although I am absolutely certain George A. Romero put way more thought into that thing
100%
than this movie did.
100%.
This movie's working on total subconscious level if it's thinking about anything too deeply.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that's my last comment. I forgot to bring up.
So. Last minute announcements here. 22nd, which here in 2 days, 3 days, I'm going to be at Cap City Comedy Club for the quarterfinals of Funniest Person in Austin. And
hey, this is how I find out about it.
And on the 26th of August, I'm going to be down in Corpus Christi, Texas, at the Lazy Beach Brewery. I'm going to be telling some jokes and hopefully making people laugh. So come on out and see those.
Awesome. Break a leg above those shows, brother. Yeah. And I'll go ahead and ask you first. Do you have a film for next week?
I do, actually. I was flipping through last night, actually through Shudder, and saw this movie. It's called The Devil's Reign. It's from 1975, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you the reason I chose this movie is because the cast intrigued me so much. It has Ernest Borgnine, Eddie Albert, Ida Lupino, William Shatner.
Oh my God, and I know this
young
movie.
Tom Skerritt. So yeah, that I saw that cast and was like, I've just got to watch this. I may as well go way back in time, you know, and because it was made the year I was born. So that's way back in time now, unfortunately, and watch this thing.
So real quick, that's called The Devil's Rain.
Like, yeah, R-A-I-N.
Yeah,
Devil's Rain.
I have not seen the movie, but when you said William Shatner, I've seen images from this movie. I'll just put it that way. And so yes, I will definitely be watching that. So that came out in 75, huh?
Yep, 1975, and it can be found on Shudder.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to go in the opposite direction. We're going to go into the future. In fact, we're going to just last year.
Nice.
We're going to discuss Jordan Peele's Nope.
Awesome, awesome. I'm definitely going to be watching that one again with you. I actually saw it last night when I was skimming through movies, and I was like, oh, yeah, I need to watch that again.
I've been wanting to rewatch it because there's a problem now today where a movie comes out in theaters, and then it comes out on home video just sometimes maybe 2 or 3 months after the theatrical. Right. So I'll get the movie on home video, but it's been so soon, I'm not ready to rewatch it. And so it gets put on my shelf. And so I saw this one and I was like, time to rewatch this one finally. It's been over a year finally. I'm ready to rewatch it. And of course, I'm a huge fan of Jordan Peele. So that that'll be my next movie.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think it's amazing that Jordan Peele is going to be this newer generation's Wes Craven and all that. You know, I love Jordan Peele. I love his movies. Nope, Wes just amazing.
Wes Craven, Rod Serling especially.
Yeah, like he's 100%.
You know, people are like, oh, he's you see Hitchcock on his. I'm like, oh, no, you see Twilight Zone in his movies.
Yeah.
And then yes, social commentary, you know, like Wes Craven and all them that did that. He's definitely picked up that mantle and made it his own. I'm not just comparing him to those previous directors.
Right.
He's taken it and embraced it, but we'll talk more about that next week when we talk about Nope.
Absolutely. All right. And until then, remember everybody, love each other. Bye.
Later.